Dark Stories, the podcast. Season 1. Coal River, True Crime. Opening an intimate window on the raw violence, resilience, humour and dumb luck characterising the crime stories from colonial Newcastle. Case file. Not a reserved girl. We are born into this world without a map. Each new life is a relative soup of random possibility, drawn together from family, animal intellect, health, and adaptability. If fate is brutally unsympathetic dealing out the combinations, religion reduces life to hope of an afterlife where pain is extinguished and eternity awaits. In this divinely ordered universe, individual action is preordained, while adventurous behaviour is judged as heretical rather than experimentation, particularly if it involves provocative females.
Sunday morning, 26 July, 1914. Accompanied by arguing dawn birds and the click of his heavy-soled boots, George trundled through the early morning Broadmeadow streets after his watchman's shift. He was considering breakfast, a bed, and drinks later that day to celebrate his birthday. The sky was lightening to navy blue when he reached the showground's main gates, where he followed the newly concreted stormwater drain, mapping his final leg home. For George, the drains camouflaged a childhood of serpentine waterways and creeks, a daydream world unpolluted by the nearby mines in water clean enough to swim, a place alive with yabbies, rats, platypus, fish, where fat ducks scattered at gunshot, and time moved to the pace of hovering, lucent bugs and dragonflies.
The drain ran parallel to the showground fence before separating near a large black-mouthed culvert. Close to this entrance, George recognised a human body on its back. He took it for a yahoo, who had drunkenly fallen in after one too many. He slid down the side wall and noticed a floral pattern peeking out from a green coat. He found himself beside a young woman whose throat was cut hideously from ear to ear. Her brown eyes stared back like she was frozen screaming. There was a man's razor lying not far from her hand. Her makeup was still set for a night out. The floral dress, fashionable as far as George understood, was ripped in places. His empty stomach churned. He couldn't bring himself to touch her. He had witnessed industrial accidents, including amputations and even death, but this was incomprehensibly vivid and unreal, made somehow worse by her pixie good looks and the serene way she lay there like a discarded doll. She may have looked familiar, but he couldn't give her a name.
Broadmeadow police fenced off the area for Newcastle detectives and a photographer constable from Wall's End. Folded arm locals formed conspiratorial groups behind the rope, already disputing unfounded conclusions and theories, a side effect of the crime scene's fence geometry, which redefined a dirt and tufted grass patch into a space of respectful purpose, full of concentration and covert possibility. The hunch police systematically poked around the area, reconstructing time and place in reverse. Each significance alerted the photographer. Clotted blood splashes along the bank of the drain, a half-crushed feathered hat with a gold pendant stuck in the uneven grass, shoe marks ran lines in the dirt back to a large pool of blood, a ghost track suggesting the victim had been bled out like an abattoir beast before being dragged, rolled in the drain. Detectives surmised the woman was abandoned while being dragged into the culvert tunnel for hiding. Perhaps the killer or killers were interrupted, had panicked, or exhausted their energy. Apart from the razor, there was no evidence of another person having been in the area. By midday, the police dispensed with George as a suspect and removed the body of local girl, Edith Horton, to the morgue for immediate autopsy.
The coroner was called from his family lunch. He found rough bruising on Edith's arms, legs, and ribs. The front of her dress was torn up to the waist. His report detailed the viciousness and precision of the wound running across Edith's throat, from just beneath the left ear to just behind the right ear, through everything to the backbone. He deemed the razor found at the scene incapable of the act. The wound presented all the features of having been inflicted by a single strike with a large knife, like a butcher's knife. The only consoling fact was that death would have been quick, no more than 1 minute after the wound was inflicted.
Edith was a 22-year-old barmaid and a single mother living with her parents in Hamilton, a casual 10 to 15-minute walk from where she was murdered. The week before her death, Edith joined excited queues for the Lyceum Picture Palace. Edith was a sight with her Pickford tiz. She splashed out on the hairstyle while walking out with a charming, peripatetic carpenter she met working at Connor's Hotel. He said she looked like the dizzyingly beautiful movie star, but he disappeared as suddenly as the end of a film reel when Edith told him she was duffed with his child. Despite a broken heart, she embraced the birth and after weaning the child, went back to work. Her parents provided their daughter and bastard grandchild with persistent and public love, immune to the prudish judgments of relatives and neighbours.
She was determined never to be a maid, and after the carpenter, never give her heart easily again. Men would be for uncomplicated fun. She left romantic fantasies for sleeping dreams or the movies, and accepted the unrelenting working days and motherhood as what life was. Good looks, a sense of humour, and a sharp tongue made her a popular barmaid. Returning to work, she met the handsome and athletic Herbert. The gasworks labourer was instantly smitten. They were the same age, but Edith quickly tired of Herbert's obsessive doting, which soon turned to sour badgering. He was yet another man-child just out of knee pants. Herbert idealised Edith as a goddess, unaware she needed saving from her wanton ways. The fact his sister was married to Edith's brother gave him complete justification to stalk her. He would turn up to her work shift, berating her for flirting openly with customers, accepting their compliments or sharing their blue jokes.
After failing to convince Herbert gently or telling him straight, Edith took to walking out with other men. Herbert was reduced to earwigging her parents about their daughter's damnation. The family drank lakes of tea over many jaded hours with the incessant young man. When Edith changed her pub work location to be closer to home, Herbert was there on her first night, drinking furtively in a corner ingle. Herbert's stalking also focused attention on Edith's public reputation as an attention-seeking floozy. Her death in the local paper euphemistically noted she was not what might be called a reserved girl. Some blamed her wildness on her parents, while others saw her death as proof of the moral degradation caused by motion pictures.
The day previous, Saturday afternoon, 25 July 1914. The Broadmeadow Showground was decked out in bunting, roped fencing and carnival rides for the visiting French aviator. The current holder of the Pommery Cup, awarded twice a year to the airman or airwoman who flew the greatest distance in one day, was in the city for a one-off aerobatic performance in The Looper, his dragonfly-like Blériot 11. The airman produced an amazing and deft exhibition of aerobatics in his two 40-minute displays that Saturday afternoon, his perpendicular dives being particularly thrilling. He inspected local medical corps and autographed cards. Local school choirs and the band of the 16th Regiment filled the afternoon with international airs, and he later told locals that during his second flight he reached Cloudland at 11,000 feet and felt confident enough to fly directly to Sydney before remembering the Newcastle Agricultural Society had arranged a smoking concert in his honour for that evening. Edith paid her shilling to see the second flight after arriving late, where she'd been visiting her sister since the Thursday. She left before the pilot landed to avoid the departing crowd gridlock and found Herbert waiting at the main gates. After a tetchy conversation, Edith agreed to meet him at the Broadmeadow tram shed between 7 and 7.25 that evening. He had bought tickets for them both and his three sisters to see Jane Eyre, One of the Rabble, The Auto Race, and Stormy Love Affairs from the popular romantic comedy series Mabel, which Edith loved so much. There were also two keystone comedies, To Dispel All Business Cares and Family Worries. Edith convinced her disagreeing mother not to worry about meeting the foolish boy. She had been too tired to argue with Herbert, and besides, she liked his sisters, who understood their silly brother. She would be straight home after the moving pictures.
Saturday night, 26th July, 1914. Herbert met his sisters at the movie theatre, but was too restless to sit and watch the full programme. He had given up waiting for Edith around 8 o'clock. He sauntered about the tram shed and surrounding hotels, taking in a beer or two with various mates and acquaintances. His elder sister advised him to slow down on the grog, even if it did quell his simmering anxiety at being jilted again, or worrying about which Romeo she was out with tonight. One suitor from the gasworks, a fireman from the sulphide works, the machine driver, or the bloke from the railways, who always wore spick and expensive cutaway frock coats. His sisters told him to forget her, which they meant leave Edith alone. Herbert wouldn't reveal to them Edith was in trouble again, and he silently hoped he was the father. After seeing his sisters off and downing a few last pots, Herbert caught the tram home to the Gully Line just before 11 p.m. He sat a while in front of the fire before falling asleep. Detectives arrived the following day to question him about the previous night. He was taken to Newcastle Police Station and kept on the grill for the rest of the day and most of Monday. On Tuesday morning, he was charged with maliciously murdering Edith. His shocked mother and sisters wept on the courthouse steps for their Herbie. He remained in custody until the inquest in early August.
By the time of the inquest, police had not progressed beyond what was found on the first day. Police photographs documented how Edith had died, but no fingerprints or footprints were discovered. The razor blade was bloodstained, but the handle had been wiped clean. While Herbert remained their chief suspect, police interviewed the list of Romeos Herbert gave them. At the inquest, these men produced solid alibis for Saturday night and Sunday morning. Their answers gave a more engaging outline of a free-spirited, if contrary, woman. The gasworks worker last saw Edith about a month before her death. She had mentioned being with child to Herbert, and jokingly, perhaps, said she would do away with herself rather than have a child go through life with Herbert as their father. She had told Herbert that another suitor was the father. Edith was also described as too smart and sharp for a girl, and good fun if she did sometimes miss an appointment with him. Yes, he thought her suicide talk was just talk. Herbert also worked at the gasworks, but the two men rarely crossed paths. A week before the murder, Herbert was overheard making noise about a co-worker trying to steal his Edith. The machine driver mentioned he liked Edith as you would a good sort, but grew tired of her habit of making appointments with different men for the same evening, and going off with the one and jilting the others. She had told the machine driver that Herbert had knocked her down, but she did not say where or when.
A senior constable from East Maitland stated he had spoken with Herbert's brother-in-law, who told him, "I believe they've got the wife's brother in connection with the Broadmeadow murder. I'm afraid they've got the right man. When he has a drop of drink in him, he is quite silly. Some time ago, he was about to shoot a girl at Currycurry, whom he'd had a difference with, and I took the revolver from him and afterwards pawned it, and added money to what I got, and bought a ring, and made it a present to him." Under sober questioning, the young constable had to admit Herbert's brother-in-law was equally prone to exaggerating with a drop of drink in him. Edith's distraught sister spoke of having pleaded with her not to meet Herbert that evening. She traumatically recalled being up all night after Edith did not return home. Her husband had said to wait until morning, thinking she'd stay with her brother, as she had done before. Sunday morning broke news of a young woman found dead in the drains. Edith's father said he generally kept out of his daughter's business. She had been keeping company with Herbert for about 6 months. Like his wife, he was troubled by the man's fecklessness and the domestic trouble he always seems to provoke. This included a fist fight between Herbert and Edith's brother, married to Herbert's sister. The two young men reconciled recently after a long and tense silence between them. The father often met Edith at the Broadmeadow railway gates after she finished night work. He knew she could look after herself, but he didn't like her being alone on lonely roads. He wanted the court to know how precious their grandchild was to them.
The inquest made brief mention of the erratic and headstrong Herbert being part of a Newcastle town larrikin gang, but this amounted to a group of young men shooting tin cans in the bush on weekends. A procedurally clueless Herbert contradicted himself throughout giving evidence, such as claiming not to have known the area Edith was murdered, before claiming it was their secret meeting spot, but was adamant he didn't kill her. The last time he saw Edith when he was watching The Flying Man. He was not at the place of the murder at all on the Saturday night. He could not say how she came by the injuries which caused her death. He had no idea. He did not possess a razor. He had no necessity for one, as he did not shave. In the end, his public conspicuousness and multiple witnesses saw Herbert released from custody with charges against him dropped. The inquest drew a red line through the theory Edith was suicidal at being pregnant and single a second time. If the razor being left at the scene was to incriminate her, it only suggested she knew her assailant. The coroner, after the autopsy, made no reference of Edith being pregnant. In the end, Edith was deemed to have been murdered by someone unknown. It was hoped the police would continue to investigate, but despite a proclamation in a government gazette offering a reward of £250 for information that will lead to the conviction of the person or persons who murdered Edith at Broadmeadow, her killer, or killers, were never found.
A master Chinese poet wrote that memory is a clouded world. By the end of 1914, a war consumed much of the Western world's energy, and Edith's murder drifted away as a forgotten file. Her pleading dead eyes remained burned into the thoughts of the man who found her body, though, and the empty shadow play of night-lit warehouses and factories that once provided George with solitary contemplation was now consumed with the adumbral presence of Edith's restless, revenant spirit, unable to articulate to him the final hours of her life. Edith's family commemorated her passing each year with a long newspaper dedication, memorializing a much-loved daughter, sister, and mother. It hinted that while the authorities had forgotten her, the family never would. Her mother and father left their church despite a scaremongering and persistent local priest. For all the choices Edith made, she treated her life as a gift of joyful purpose. Religion exploited this, the priest claiming any good in her life was merely a reflection of God's love. Her baptism might save her, but her parents considered this a fickle insult after what their daughter had suffered in this world. The grief of paternal love was all that mattered, something beyond the scale judgment of what God decided might be right or wrong at the time. The family politely told the priest to leave.
In the later summer of 1915, some gangs of Sydney larrikins caught the train to Newcastle for a town festival. They caused mayhem in local hotels, demanding free drinks and sparking street fights. They manhandled a barmaid going home from work into a laneway, where she was saved by passing constables, but not before having her clothes partially ripped off. After threatening her with a butcher's knife, they told her to stop screaming or she'd end up like that prissy slut from Broadmeadow. The thugs responsible escaped on the last train that night. Those arrested were released with fines and a police sergeant's boot up the arse the following morning. Similar gangs had worked the crowds at the Aero Show the previous year, but were never considered seriously in the original investigations into Edith's murder. Thank you for listening. This podcast has been narrated by David
and Elizabeth.
For more information, please visit hunterlivinghistories.com. Or to find out more about David
and Elizabeth,
please search on www.darkstories.com.au. Or join the author's Facebook page by searching for the Facebook group On Ground Level. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, and subscribe to receive future episodes. Until next crime, this case is closed.